supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Support for Voices in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. When you enter a store, how do you feel? I know there are some people who might host psychology call-in radio shows at WHYY, who feel that their lifeblood is just draining away from them. But for others, it's actually an adrenaline rush. It feels good to go into a store. For others, it's almost a sense of identity. And yet, for others, it's an attempt to almost repair something.
What is it about shopping? I mean, like, something new. It's always good to have something new. Makes you feel good.
But what happens when that feel-good feeling goes away and shopping brings guilt and shame? And why do people become addicted anyway to something like shopping? Well, joining me now to discuss this issue is Dr. April Benson. She's a psychologist who specializes in treatment of compulsive buying and the author of To Buy or Not to Buy. April, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Dan. It's a pleasure.
Our phone number, if you want to join the conversation, is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. If you feel you've got a shopping problem, or maybe you feel you get just great pleasure out of shopping and it's not a problem, give us a call. 888-477-9499. April, most behaviors get labeled addiction when they begin to interfere with our lifestyles. Is that true with compulsive shopping?
Very much so, Dan. The impairment to us, it comes on many levels. The most common, and the one we think of the most, is there are financial consequences to runaway shopping. But there are many other consequences as well. Consequences to relationships are enormous. Many, many marriages break up over issues related to money, and many of those related to compulsive spending. Beyond that, there are occupational consequences. Sometimes somebody gets fired because what they do all day on the internet, and Cyber Monday is the perfect day to talk about this, is to shop. And other people have to work two or three jobs to pay the minimum on credit card bills where what was purchased was really stuff that the person didn't need and wouldn't use.
So when you determine whether someone is a compulsive shopper, what questions do you ask in making your assessment?
Well, there are a number of questions to ask. There is a new research tool that asks just six questions. And
what are they?
The questions are, do you have unopened shopping bags in your closet, and you rate yourself on a 1 to 7 scale? So that's the first item. And most people would consider me a shopaholic, is another one of the items. I spend a lot of money I didn't intend to, is yet another. And
that last one is a question you'd ask for someone with a gambling addiction, too.
Yes. Yes, I think that there are a lot of similarities.
And go on. What are some of the others?
Much of my life centers around buying things. I consider myself an impulse purchaser. I buy things I did not plan to buy. And on a 1 to 7 scale, with 1 meaning never and 7 indicating very often, or for the other questions, 1 meaning strongly disagree and 7 meaning strongly agree, it's been found that someone who scores a 25 or more on that test is considered a compulsive buyer.
Help me understand the emotions, the feelings behind this. As I implied not too subtly in my introduction, that on a personal level, I don't get it. I go into a store and something inside my brain just goes to sleep, you know? I go into a store when I need a shirt. I find a shirt,
sure.
I feel proud of myself, and I'm out of there.
Sure, you're typical of many men for whom, you know, I think Rob Becker said in Defending the Caveman.
I was just thinking of that.
Yeah. Women go out and they gather, and men hunt down that shirt.
Right, right. And that's just what it feels like. So tell me what happens inside of a compulsive shopper. Is it about the purchase, or is it about the process? Or?
It's very different depending on who the compulsive buyer is. It used to be thought that it was about the purchase, the moment of purchase, and not about the item. That's not true of many people. For many people, it is about the item.
April?
Yes?
Is your phone consistent because your voice is going in and out?
Oh, sorry.
Okay. So go on.
So for many people, it's about the item. It's about what it is they're buying, and the problem is that they're buying it for emotional reasons, not because they need it, and not even if they can't afford it. So there's some attempt to make up for some kind of perceived lack, whether it's self-esteem, whether it's a feeling about being esteemed by other people.
Is that a safe generalization to compensate for something that's missing?
I think it is a safe generalization.
Okay. All right. So how did you become interested in the field?
I had a childhood experience that clued me in to what shopping might be about, at least some of what shopping might be about. And in a nutshell, that experience was I noticed how my next-door neighbor and her daughter shopped versus the way my mother and I shopped. I also noticed that this next-door neighbor had a store that she went to where she was really treated like royalty. And she'd go in there, and if they didn't have her size or her color, they would order it. They'd sit her down for coffee and rugula.
And what was your experience when you shopped with your mother?
Well, it was my mother grew up during the Depression, and everything with her was the price. And that became the axis around our shopping experiences.
It was the opposite experience,
yes,
you had with your friend. Listen, we're going to take a short break, April. When we come back, I want to continue this story and see what shopping meant then to you, what it means now to you. And then we want to bring in another guest. We've got James Mitchell, who's going to join us in our next segment. He's president of the Neuropsychiatric Research Institute, and he's chairman of the Clinical Neuroscience Department at the University of North Dakota, and he's going to weigh in on shopping addiction also. That's what we're talking about. Our phone number is 888-477-9499. If you feel shopping means more to you than simply purchasing something, give us a call. Or if you feel you have a loved one who might be shopping compulsively or addictively, give us a call, 888-477-9499. We'll be back after a short break. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and you're listening to Voices in the Family, That's right here on WHYY-FM, Philadelphia.
The Clay Studio supports WHYY. Their holiday exhibition, Gifted, presents unique and accessible objects with functional works by over 100 artists now through December 28th. Located at 137 North 2nd Street in Old City, the Clay Studio is open Tuesdays through Saturdays 11 to 7 and Sundays noon to 6. Details at theclaystudio.org or 215-925-3453. The Clay Studio, shaping the future of ceramics.
Do you remember these stories on WHYY? Mike Huckabee wins the Republican Iowa caucus, the 7.2 magnitude earthquake in China, Starbucks says it will close 500 stores. You heard these stories in January, May, and July, and you probably listened to a lot of our coverage of the election and the economy. The news on WHYY is made possible with listener contributions. Please give today at whyy.org. You'll hear your dollars at work every day in the coming year.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about shopping addiction, what it means, what goes on inside, and what the missing pieces are. My guest is Dr. April Lane Benson. She's director of Stopping Over Shopping, and she's the author of To Buy or Not to Buy. By the way, she's got a webpage, stoppingovershopping.com. And in a few minutes, we'll be joined by Dr. James Mitchell, who's president of the Neuropsychiatric Research Institute at the University of North Dakota. So, April, when we last left off, you were talking about two different shopping experiences you had in your childhood. One, if I can oversimplify, and I apologize for doing it, is a sense of deprivation that you might have had with your mother.
Mm-hmm.
And when you went with your friend's mother, it was almost the opposite experience, that you were important. You had, sure, the mother had more of a sense.
Well, it wasn't really about her mother vis-a-vis mine and showing their care. It was the care that she showed to herself. That's what really it piqued my interest, that she felt she deserved nice things and that forming a relationship with a store was something that, you know, I'd never imagined.
So as you grew up, you wanted to be a VIP in a store, and apparently you were successful, yes?
There was a store that I shopped at for 20 years based on this desire I had. You know, it was a block from my house, and so it was very easy for me to run in there. And over the course of the 20 years that I shopped at this particular store, I felt like I really healed some of these wounds. Now, it wasn't a clear trajectory. There was definitely a period of compulsive buying about this. But what happened was that by the time the store closed, and it actually closed 20 years later, and it was the store's closing that prompted me to write a piece called When Shopping Heals. And that's really how I began.
Well, I would imagine most people have the opposite experience, that, you know, shopping to heal a wound usually does not work and creates more problems.
Absolutely.
So you're in a minority. I guess I would imagine a very small minority.
I think some of it had to do with the fact that simultaneously I was starting to get interested in shopping, and I was starting to wonder about my own shopping behavior. So it was me working with myself around this simultaneously.
Yeah, and even just as important as working with yourself was you were also observing yourself in a dispassionate way.
Yes.
As a scientist would. I looked up your background, your professional one, and it's psychoanalytic in nature. And, you know, just from that perspective, April, many of our psychoanalytic colleagues would suggest that the shopping was about your relationship with your mother rather than the relationship with the store.
Yes.
But you disagree.
No. I think the store stood in for a very good mother in certain respects.
And it worked.
Yeah.
Let's go to the phones. We've got Sean on the line.
Sean? Hi, Dan. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to make the point that I don't think it's just as simple as being a shopaholic or not being a shopaholic. For me, it depends on where I am. If I walk into a grocery store for milk, cheese, and butter, I walk out with 30 things, you know, and it's like, holy cow, I can get two boxes of cereal for the price of one, or, oh, I could use some gum. You know, it's those impulse buys that sometimes are motivated by a sale. But just like you, if I walk into a mall, I'm just there for a sweater. I'm just there for a pair of shoes, and I got to get out of there.
Well, there's some great generalizations we could make here because, in my research for the show, what I find is men tend to like grocery shopping and hate malls. I know I'm in that category, and women, it's the opposite. April, what's your research show?
I think that men... I'm interested in the grocery store issue because it hasn't been my experience yet that the men that I've worked with have been grocery shoppers, and it makes sense to me because I think my husband is a grocery shopper and he's allergic to malls, but maybe with people who are really compulsive. As you say you are, certainly, planning to purchase two things and walking out with 30.
Well, I want to underscore something Sean said, April, that I kind of bypassed. Sean, I think I heard you saying you're raising a question about am I compulsive because I think I'm an impulse shopper, and are they the same thing?
It's a very good question. The test that we just talked about is unique because it contains items. Three of the items relate to impulse control problems, and three relate to obsessive compulsive problems, because I think there's really a blend.
Yeah. Sean? Well, I don't know if we have him, but I hope he got his answer. Listen, I want to bring on now James Mitchell because I've got an interview I'd like you both to hear. James, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
James Mitchell is president of the Neuropsychiatric Research Institute, chairman of Clinical Neuroscience Department at the University of Dakota. Thanks so much for joining us. I'd like you both to hear an interview one of our producers, Gita Simons, did at the mall with someone who wanted to talk about their shopping behavior. Let's listen.
Why do you think shopping might be a problem in your life?
Well, the first thing is that I don't really have a serious handle on my money and my spending. I don't feel like I have any control over, as soon as I get paid, as soon as I get a paycheck, I have all the things lined up that I want to purchase. So that's a problem.
And then how does it feel when you shop?
When I shop, I go into some sort of a semi-trance state. It's almost like a narcosis where I'm in this like blissful state where I kind of I lose all track of time. And this has been the case my whole life. I mean, I remember shopping even as a child, like the first opportunities I could get to shop. And I just remember like really finding the pleasure of browsing, like slowly walking through the store and touching certain things. Even when I went to Russia as a teenager, and there was nothing to buy there. And it was fascinating because people would go and they would finger this naga hide that was for sale because that was all that was there to buy. Because the experience of, this tactile experience going into the store and being able to like hold things and touch them. And I always say, like, when I'm in a store, it's as if I own it, the item, while I'm in the store. It's like I have ownership of it, even if I put it back when I leave.
But then what happens when you do buy it and you take it home?
When I buy something, I have this incredible pleasurable feeling. And even if I forget exactly what it is that I bought, I still, like, I'll have this thrill that I know, like, oh, I have a new thing, and I'll bring it home. And even if I forget, like, oh, specifically I bought new shoes, like, I'll be like, oh, I have a new thing.
Is shopping part of your identity? Or say you're having a down day. Can shopping turn that around for you?
Yeah, I mean, when I had money left on my credit card, it was great. I mean, I feel like I had an unlimited ability to go in and access that drug-like trance state, you know, that comes with shopping.
And how long did the trance last? Say, when you bought an item, how long would that feeling stay with you?
At least that day. Yeah, I don't think it would last through into another day. But I think since money's gotten tighter for me, I've really had to look at the way I spend money and how I'm shopping, and I'm not going, very infrequently now, going shopping. I haven't bought new shoes. I haven't bought much in the way of new clothing in months, and that's only because, you know, more pressing things are at hand, like the electric bill.
That was our producer, Gita Simons, interviewing a woman who feels she's got a compulsive shopping problem. James, I want to turn to you. She described a sensation when she goes into a store that sounded physiological, sounded narcotic-like. What's happening in her brain?
Well, we really don't know. There really haven't been any good brain imaging studies done in this population yet. But for a lot of people, the behavior is quite pleasurable. But they are fully conscious of what they're doing. There doesn't appear to be any evidence of any kind of epileptiform activity or anything like that.
So what's the connection, then, between neuroscience and compulsive shopping?
Well, we don't know yet. One of the issues that hasn't come up yet on this hour is that a lot of people who are compulsive buyers have other kinds of psychopathology. There are very high rates of depression, of anxiety disorders, and a number of these people have other kinds of impulsive or compulsive behaviors. For example, there's significant overlap with problems with gambling. And in some of the published research, there's a higher than expected rate of alcohol and drug abuse. So it's hard to isolate out. It's very rare to find someone who only has a compulsive buying problem. Usually there are other problems there as well.
Tell us about the genetics.
We don't know much about genetics. Anecdotally, it does appear to run in families, but separating out environment from heredity is difficult with a complex behavior like this. But we do know that most forms of psychopathology do have genetic underpinnings, but there really have not been any good genetic studies done in compulsive buyers yet.
Well, you talked about other types of psychopathology that appear with compulsive shopping. And, of course, that happens with most kinds of addictive, compulsive behaviors. Is there a medication that's helpful? Because there are some medications that are helpful with other compulsive behaviors.
Well, there have been positive reports of using antidepressant drugs, such as the serotonin reuptake inhibitors. But in the actual control trials that have been done, the medications have been blatantly ineffective. And probably don't play much of a role. They may play a role in treating some of the other comorbid conditions like depression, but they don't seem to have a very powerful effect on the shopping itself.
Almost all the studies are mostly or exclusively with women.
Yes.
How come men are compulsive shoppers too? The research I read was I was surprised. It's almost 50-50.
In prevalent studies, it's 50-50. Almost exactly 50-50, but in treatment studies, it's usually 80 or 90% women. So the men are not treatment-seeking. For example, when we advertise for treatment studies, we very, very rarely get calls from men.
Let me turn to you. April, are you there?
Yes, I am.
So is that consistent with your practice, too? Is it the vast majority women?
No. You mean in my... Well, I would say... 80%.
Yeah, that's consistent with what James is saying. So I wonder then if the euphoria that women get is the same as men? Is there something different going on between the genders?
Well, that's a very interesting question. One of the problems is nobody has reported many males, any detailed information on males, and that's something that should be looked at. We know that the items that they buy frequently are quite different from what women
right.
buy. They tend to specialize in things like books or electronics. It's a very important question. Why don't the men come in, and are they different from the women?
I want to ask you both a question, that if this is truly an addiction, I wonder if they feel some kind of withdrawal, if they stop abruptly. I'll start with you, James.
Well, I think conceptualizing it as an addiction is in some ways misleading and confusing for people. I tend not to see it that way. I just don't think that's a useful construct to apply. Do people go into withdrawal? Well, we know when people stop any kind of problematic behavior, for a while their mood worsens, they have to develop new coping skills. So generally people do have a decrement in their mood, their mood goes down, their anxiety levels go up, and that's true whenever you give up any kind of problematic behavior.
So before I turn to April, why is it misleading to call it an addiction? Why is it problematic?
Well, basically, I think of addictions as needing to be treated by teaching people to avoid the substance. And people are going to have to shop. What they need to learn how to do is to shop responsibly. Also, this concept of loss of control. Most people say, yes, I lose control, but when you actually pin them down, they kind of decide to lose control and engage in the behavior. So at least using the treatment model we use, we teach people to regain that sense of control part of the treatment.
April, what are your thoughts about that?
I agree totally with what Jim has to say about the addiction idea, although I think sometimes in our wording we get sloppy and use it. You know, I don't think that's a tragedy, but I do think that what I do is I really help people to know what to expect as they stop over-shopping. I talk to them about needing to understand that the difficult feelings that they're then having have to do with them not blotting them out with the shopping. And I talk to them about bracing themselves, because when they first begin to resist, you know, the feelings are likely to be strongest. And once they get some techniques and strategies under their belts, they get some success, and that builds on itself.
You have said, April, that it's important to find triggers. And you know, I want to again come to your psychoanalytic background, which tells you, us, those of us who were trained in that, that let's find the original cause, the conflict, the source of the suffering. Yes?
Where it all came from is something we do in the very first homework assignment.
Huh.
Why do you overshop, and how did it all begin? And there is a structured questionnaire related to history and memories about shopping, spending, and stuff, and then some attempt to integrate that in terms of how it affected their overshopping behavior. And now that they're older, how can they rethink this?
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Michelle on the line. Michelle, hi, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hi, what can we do for you?
Oh, no, I just wanted to know, because I suspect that my husband has overshopping online with the books. And I have been telling him about it. It actually, I don't know, I'm listening to what you're saying, and I'm doing a lot of readings myself about this. And I know there was this porn addiction before, and that went down. And then what came back was a book buying, compulsive book buying. And we're also kind of financially not, we don't have a lot, we're in the hole. And I still see it's happening. And then, I don't know, it's just, I don't know, the books are not being read. They just go on the shelf.
Mm-hmm.
They're being, some of them are being referenced. And it's almost every 2 or 3 days. It's kind of hurting our marriage in a case that I have to actually.
Okay, I'm going to ask you to hold on, because I want both our guests to weigh in on this, but don't go anywhere, okay? So there's a couple of issues that come up here. You know, one is, what can a spouse do, if especially a female spouse, if she thinks her husband is behaving in an addictive way? And the other issue that we can talk about a bit later is online shopping, which I know is a big deal. April, let's start with you. What can a spouse do?
Well, I think a spouse can find a good time to approach the other spouse, and the caller has already started doing some positive things by doing some reading. And when it's a good time, you can approach the spouse by saying what it is that you've noticed, not judging, but just saying what it is that you've seen. And so that the other person doesn't feel so defensive. And then I think joining with them by telling them that you've been actually doing some reading and listening and learning about this kind of issue, and that you know that there is effective help available, and that it may be too difficult for him to handle this on his own. He may need some support, and there are online support groups, there are in-person support groups, you know, not a lot, but there is some effective help available if he is ready.
And one place you could look would be at April's webpage of stopovershopping.com. James, what are your thoughts about what a spouse can do, especially, and I'm thinking about what a wife can do, because you talked about, you know, how men, I don't know if they're treatment resistant, but they're less likely to seek treatment.
Well, I agree with April that this sort of a consistent, firm approach of bringing it up repeatedly, a lot of times you have to sort of wear people down. I disagree with April a little bit, though, that I don't think there are very many treatment resources out there. And I think it's a major problem right now that a lot of people, a lot of places really don't get access to good care.
Well, what we do have here in the Philadelphia area, if Michelle is from the Philadelphia area, is we do have several good programs around that treat anxiety disorders. Now, mm-hmm. is that make sense?
Well, we don't know if an anxiety disorder treatment is going to improve compulsive buying. It seems to me that the behaviors are so set that you really have to deal with them directly. And a lot of therapists just don't have enough experience with these people.
Yeah, but the reason I'm bringing up anxiety disorders, I mean, there's a good one at Temple. There's a nationally known one in Bala Cynwyd here in the suburbs of Philadelphia. And one of the things they specialize in is OCD.
Yeah. Well, again, if you know how to approach the shopping problem, that's fine, but a lot of therapists don't. And most people we see have been frustrated with the fact that they haven't been able to locate treatment resources.
Yeah, and that's...
And, as an aside, one of the things we've done, funded by a grant from the Bremer Foundation, is put our treatment manual that we developed and have now studied in 2 trials available on the web for therapists to use. If people go to the website for the Neuropsychiatric Research Institute, they can download a copy of the manual and use it in their clinical practice.
Well, that's helpful, because we have a lot of therapists listening to the program. And what's your website, Jim?
www.nri, FARGO, NRIFargo.com, and then go to the NRI Press, and there's a copy of the manual there for download.
Okay. Maggie, are you there? I'm sorry, Michelle, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Well, I've got one other thought I'd like to weigh in on this, even though I'm not an expert on shopping addiction. But I do know that the underpinnings of any compulsive behavior, and your husband's had this twice now, is discomfort. He's got to feel uncomfortable inside his own skin. There's got to be something in there that hurts him. And if you can address it that way, that he's got discomfort, and his discomfort is causing you discomfort, and everybody needs help. And you know, either ask him to go, or offer to go with him.
I'm not from Philadelphia, but I think you're right because we are discovering something similar in counseling, and I think it was you are on the right track. So
it's about pain, and it's about hurting.
Okay.
All right, Michelle.
Thanks so much.
Take care.
Okay, bye.
Well, we've got to take a short break, and I want to talk more about the therapies that are involved and that are helpful. We're talking about April Lane Benson, a psychiatrist who's director of Stopping Over Shopping. She's written To Buy or Not to Buy. And we're also talking with James Mitchell, who's president of the Neuropsychiatric Research Institute at the University of North Dakota. Well, we'll be back in just 60 seconds. We'll take more of your phone calls and talk about treatment and treatment options. You're listening to Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. That's right here on WHYY-FM, Philadelphia.
Dance Celebration presents Doug Verrone and dancers at Annenberg Center for the Performing Arts, Thursday, December 4th through Saturday, December 6th, featuring three Philadelphia premieres. Choreographer Verrone also brings Bessie Award winner Boats Leaving to the Annenberg Center. Verrone brings a unique style to the stage, celebrating the art of movement. His credits range from film and opera to theater and dance. For tickets, 215-898-3900 or online at pennpresents.org. Dance Celebration supports WHYY.
Things getting a little tense at work?
I'm clicking!
Don't let a busy day get the best of you.
Okay, forget it. Forget it.
Even when you're busy, day-to-day keeps you informed with what's happening in the world. And we even let you have a little fun.
It's great.
Make the most of your time.
A million things I can do.
Join us for NPR's Day-to-Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about compulsive shopping, compulsive overshopping. My guests are Dr. James Mitchell. He's president of the Neuropsychiatric Research Institute at the University of North Dakota. I'm also joined by April Lane Benson, a psychologist in New York who specializes in shopping. She's the author of To Buy or Not to Buy, and her website is stoppingovershopping.com. I want to talk a bit about treatment. James, you've done studies here in the United States and in Germany using cognitive behavioral therapy. You've had some pretty impressive results.
Yes, it seems to work quite well. Actually, we were quite pleased with the results of the first study and particularly pleased that the results were well-maintained at the follow-up with very little attrition. So, then, as you said, we did a second study in Germany. We're actually doing a larger study now where we're actually have added another treatment cell, which is a supervised self-help cell, to see if we can successfully treat people with using supervised self-help.
Well, you talk about self-help, and I want to bring up the opposite with you and with you, April, because the issue came up here, and that's the issue of groups. I know, Jim, you advocate group therapy partly for financial reasons, but there's other reasons why you advocate groups, yes?
Well, I think groups can be very powerful when people are trying to overcome problem behaviors like this. And unfortunately, it's not practical in a lot of treatment situations because therapists are not going to be able to recruit an adequate sample. to start groups. And these are closed groups that are all working forward over a number of different lessons. So I think individual probably works fine as well. We just had more experience with groups. And I think groups offer some very powerful things, shared learning, at the mutual altruism that develops in groups, the support.
Let me stop you with that word, altruism. Mm-hmm. What is it about that? Is that particularly important for compulsive shoppers or compulsive anything, altruism?
I think it's particularly important for people who have self-esteem problems. And a lot of these people do.
Yeah, that's kind of counterintuitive, isn't it? But it works.
Mm-hmm, I think so.
You know, self-esteem, most have people focus on the self when self-esteem is a problem, but altruism is the opposite.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and our experience has been that these groups really become quite cohesive.
Yeah.
Hey,
April, what's your experience with groups?
Well, I think that the kind of work I do is very similar to what Jim does. And I run groups, and I think that an additional strong point of groups is that it reduces the isolation and shame. Other people have this same problem. Hmm. And seeing that they can meet goals encourages you to meet goals. So I think it's very, very powerful.
Hmm. Let's go back to the phones. We've got George on the line. Hi, George. You're on the air.
Hello, doctor. Thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
I'm a bankruptcy lawyer. I've been a bankruptcy attorney in the Philadelphia region for about 20 years. And I've talked to a lot of people who don't understand how they got into the debt that they're in. And I think what happens is when you're on the floor and you're deciding on the floor of the electronics store, and you're trying to decide whether to buy the iPod or not, and you know it costs $300. What you should think is, well, that's $300. That's either a couple of trips to the grocery store, or it's a car payment, or it's a set of back-to-school clothes for my child, and that's what I'm going to have to part with to get the iPod. But because I have a credit card, that's not the cost-benefit analysis that I go through. What that iPod is going to cost me is $9, because if I buy a $300 iPod now, my credit card bill will be $9 higher next month, and I think that's all that these individuals see. And those who research in this field, I think, need to understand that they don't, that these individuals don't understand the true cost benefit of what they're doing. It's just not costing them what they think it is.
No, and I mean the. Your question opens up the door to the bigger question. I mean, we are living in a world now. I mean, what credit cards do to seduce people, mortgage companies have done to seduce people,
right.
And the whole world does. I said in my opening of today's show, there's a TV commercial, I forget which one it is, that actually says, change your TV, change your life. I mean, that's how out of control we are. So
I don't think people understand what the dollars really cost them. I've talked to hundreds of clients that take home maybe $4,500 a month, and they have a $3,000 mortgage debt per month between their mortgage and their home equity loan, and they would never think of giving up the house. But my point is, you're not. I think that you may be assuming that we understand the true cost, that we're giving up a set of back-to-school clothes for our son if we buy the iPod. But that's just not what I don't think that's what our brains are thinking. They're thinking, next month, my credit card bill will be $9 higher, and I can handle that.
Well, I
think you're right.
Yeah,
100%
gonna...
right. And actually, a crucial part of the CBT is getting people to give up their credit cards. And most of them are very resistant to it at first, but it's a central theme in the therapy.
I do a similar thing. I send people to, they have to list all of their credit cards and how much debt there is on each card. I send them to an online calculator where they take a look at how long it will take to pay back their debt if they just pay the minimum, if they pay the minimum as a fixed, or the happier truth if they're able to pay even more. But that's all predicated on them stopping, ceasing, and desisting credit cards now.
Well, yes, that part I understand. There's another step. If I am in an electronic store and I see that iPod and I am loving it, and I want to turn to you, James, as a neuroscientist. Something's going on in my brain, and how am I going to get control over that?
Well, another thing we introduce early in treatment is what we call the 24-hour rule. You can never buy anything that you didn't have on a list when you went shopping unless you wait 24 hours. And it forces people to think about it. And a lot of times they end up not going back and buying it.
I want to get to follow up with something George said. And George, thanks so much for your call. It brings up a really important set of issues. April, you used the phrase when we spoke with you earlier, financial fitness. What does that mean? Clearly it means throwing away your credit cards.
For me, it means to understand something about the centrality of savings and to look into how you developed the savings scripts that you have, because we know that we haven't saved this little in this country since the Great Depression. People are not saving money.
Why is that?
You know, I think our whole society is geared toward more, bigger, better now. It's not about tomorrow. It's about today. Something I wanted to say is that, speaking of wanting it today, I think the 24-hour rule is a great one. Something that I use is people write 6 questions on a little card, and I ask them to have it laminated. And in fact, there is one of these cards at the end of each of my new books. That was something that was important to me for people to have. And it's got 6 questions. Why am I, at the moment you have the impulse, I recommend that people sit down with a piece of paper and a pencil, a little journal, and answer these 6 questions in writing. Why am I here? How do I feel? What if I wait? Do I need this? In fact, do I need this is even before what if I wait. And then, how will I pay for it? Where will I put it? And if you can take the time to write down the answers to those questions, it is so much less likely that you're going to make a compulsive purchase. Now, it's not everything, but it's one way of putting space between you and the impulse to give you a chance to really think it through.
Which is exactly what all of the newer therapies in dealing with any compulsive behavior is trying to do, is giving you space and between the thought and the impulse, and that's even neurologically important, isn't it, Jim? I mean,
I think so. I think it's very important.
Yeah, and it's hard to do. It's harder to do. We had a caller who is involved with Debtors Anonymous, and they're in a 12-step program that they say is helping them. What about 12-step programs?
I think Debtors Anonymous can be enormously helpful. There are certain cities that have compulsive spender Debtors Anonymous groups, because one negative I have heard is that at many Debtors Anonymous meetings, people with a variety of different money disorders appear. People who are under-earning, people who are debting compulsively, people who can't allow to have any money at all. And sometimes compulsive buyers feel kind of unseen with people who really can't earn enough money to make a living.
So, yeah, so it's more complicated than it appears on the surface. I'm going to ask you our last question, because you used some language, April, that we haven't used in the show yet. You said in most of your writings, you teach your patients to enlist their heart, body, mind, and soul to deal with this. That we haven't heard that language today. How does that look?
I think that we've got to access whatever resources we have. We have to marshal them in helping us to control this problem, whether we call it an addiction or not. And some of it has to do with discovering what it is you're really shopping for. Are you shopping because you're lonely? Are you shopping because you're bored? Are you shopping because it's a way to deal with some kind of loss or a way to belong to an image-obsessed society? Why are you over-shopping?
Well, I think on that note, we're going to have to thank both of my guests and certainly thank all of our callers for joining us today. Jim, before I say goodbye to you, what is your website again?
www.nrifargo.
And what's NRI?
The Neuropsychiatric Research Institute.
NRI?
Fargo, F-A-R-G-O.
.com. Okay, thanks so much. That's Jim Mitchell. He's a neuroscientist, and he's president of the Neuropsychiatric Research Institute. He's also chairman of the Clinical Neuroscience Department at the University of North Dakota. Thanks for joining us, Jim.
Thanks for having me.
My other guest today has been April Lane Benson. She's a psychologist and director of Overshopping and author of To Buy or Not to Buy. You can visit her website at stoppingovershopping.com. April, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm happy to do it, and thanks so much for the work you do.
Thanks.
Next week on Voices in the Family, we'll be talking about community involvement. This in the wake of Barack Obama's victory. Many have argued that part of the reason he won is because of his community organizing skills. He was able to mobilize a country to support him, and he's promised to continue that mobilization process to keep us active in politics and in the community. Tune in. Well, you can reach us at voices@whyy.org. You can reach me directly at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Thank you, Al. Elizabeth Perez Luna is the executive producer of radio content at WHYY. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Voices in the Family is co-produced by Gita Simons and Alisa Walters. And I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Enjoy your week, my friends.